I'd like to start by thanking everybody here that's not getting paid. Yeah, I'm serious. It hasn't been easy, and that I'm talking to government and to all the folks that work so hard here in the courts. So we'll call our first case 24-990-2431-98 Michelin and Aboye versus the warden at the Moshannon Valley Processing Center. Mr. McCarter. Good morning, Mr. McCarter.
Good morning, Judge Estrepp.
It's afternoon, by the way.
Afternoon, exactly.
Yeah. He's getting paid, too.
Yeah.
May it please the court. Joseph McCarter on behalf of the government. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, there are two cases on appeal today and two issues. The first issue is sovereign immunity, and that's on appeal in both cases. The second issue is substantial justification, and that's only on appeal in Mr. Aboye's case. So I'll start with the sovereign immunity issue that's at issue in both cases. I
mean, the problem is when you start, you look at, you know, we get these every year, and habeas is in the civil section. So isn't the best you could argue that maybe it's a hybrid, that it involves, you know, starting in England, you're convicted on a criminal trial and you say to the Lord Chancellor, it wasn't fair. Would you take this case under advisement and see if I was treated fairly? And the Lord Chancellor, if he agrees that there might be something there, would issue the, you know, from the Latin word bare habeas, bring the body to me, we'll take a look at it. But isn't that the most you can argue?
Well, Your Honor, even if we were arguing that it's just a hybrid proceeding, that's enough to create ambiguity and
But why? Any it means any. There's nothing. If you say it's a hybrid proceeding, that means, yeah, it's civil. It's also criminal. It's got a little bit of both. But they specifically excluded torts. So they knew how to exclude something from any. So you're asking us to take the word any and transfer it into the word some. That's what you want us to do. You want us to strike any from the statute and insert some as a replacement. If it was some, then the fact that it was a hybrid, you could argue, look, it's not really civil, it's a hybrid, but any is any.
Well, Judge McKee,
I should add, we're all textualists now, to quote Justice Kagan. So I know there are times when textualism doesn't help the government and they're no longer textualists, but let's assume that we're textualists and we have to be guided by the terms of the statute. Any means any.
Well, Judge McKee, while the word any does precede the phrase civil action, any does not reach habeas if it's not a civil action in the first place. That's what the inquiry today is. Does it fall within the phrase civil action? If it does, then of course any would reach
habeas. What is it? What is it if it's not a civil action? You agree it's not criminal.
We agree it's not criminal, Your Honor. But while the Supreme Court has stated that while the civil label has been applied to habeas.
The court has applied that label. The Supreme Court, consistently since, I think, 1878, has applied that label, civil, to habeas proceedings.
Judge McKee, the Supreme Court has applied the civil label to habeas to distinguish it from criminal proceedings. But the Supreme Court in Harris versus Nelson stated that the civil label as applied to habeas, it's gross and inexact. It exceedingly simplifies habeas's complex history, and so it's a unique proceeding. And following Harris's guidance, whenever the Supreme Court has addressed important differences between habeas proceedings and civil proceedings, it has held that habeas is not a civil action under whichever the statute was that was issued in those cases.
That's the PLRA?
This court did reach that conclusion in the PLRA in Santana, which I believe you were on the panel of, Judge McKee. And the reason this court held so in PLRA context is because this court agreed with its sister circuits that habeas is a hybrid proceeding that's neither wholly civil nor criminal, and so it's a class unto its own.
I'm not quite sure that was the reason that we held that. It was a concern about expanding legal representation and affording access to the courts, which if we apply that same concern here, and I don't think we can because statutory interpretation, it would come out the other way. And even Justice Alito, and then not Justice Alito, Judge Alito, then agreed that it was important to expand access to counsel in interpreting the PLRA.
Well, Your Honor, what the government uses Santana for is to say that this court agreed that habeas is a hybrid proceeding. And so when you apply that same reasoning in the Equal Access to Justice Act context, it aligns this court with every other court of appeal that has answered the question, is habeas a civil action under the EJA? All of those courts dealt with criminal detention, but then the Fourth and the Fifth Circuits recently reached the same conclusion that habeas is a hybrid proceeding that's unique. It's not a civil action under the EJA. The Fourth and Fifth Circuits reached that same conclusion even when the underlying detention being challenged was immigration. And so the reasoning from Santana that habeas is a hybrid proceeding, when you apply that to the EJA context, it aligns this court with other circuits.
But what is a hybrid proceeding? What do you mean by hybrid proceeding? What does hybrid refer to?
The Supreme Court, when it has been confronted with important differences between habeas and civil proceedings, it's held that habeas is not a civil action. So a few examples.
But what does hybrid refer to? What do you mean by hybrid?
That it's a class of its own. Well, what other courts have reasoned is that because the habeas statutes focus so heavily on criminal detention are influenced by that focus on criminal, which makes it not a wholly civil proceeding. So I would say not a wholly civil proceeding is what a hybrid.
It agreed that habeas is a civil proceeding, even though the underlying detention is pursuant to a criminal conviction.
It has been labeled as civil throughout history, but Harris's guidance tells us that the label is not enough to resolve the ambiguity of whether habeas is a civil action under the EJA. You have to look context by context, and courts of appeal are in agreement. Now, I'll get to the circuit split when there's immigration detention at issue, but whenever there's been criminal detention, the courts of appeals that have addressed the issue have all held that it's a hybrid proceeding and so not.
Why don't you get to this circuit split then? Because we're in our world here, this is an immigration detention, not a criminal detention, correct?
Correct. So addressing the circuit split, and I will just sort of make a big picture observation, is that appellate judges around the country who are experts in the law are disagreeing about what exactly civil action means in the EJA. So I think that alone suggests that we may be dealing with an ambiguous phrase. But to get into the details of the circuit split, the Fourth and the Fifth Circuits have held that even when a habeas petitioner is challenging immigration detention, which is a civil proceeding, it doesn't matter what the underlying detention is. The same reasoning that habeas is a civil, or is that it is a hybrid proceeding and not a civil action to EJA, that same reasoning follows when the challenge is immigration detention.
Didn't those circuits lean heavily on opinions that dealt with criminal habeas cases?
Well, not the recent Abanda-Segura and Barco versus Witt decisions. Those courts had prior precedents that held that in the criminal challenging criminal detention, that was not a civil action under the EJA, but the recent decisions also reached the same conclusion when dealing with immigration detention.
Didn't the application in 2005, Bacchio, that said that habeas actions are civil?
Yes, so the Bacchio court from the Second Circuit, that is the court that created this carve-out for immigration.
So what's immigration? What's the carve-out? Looks like when you look at the conflict in the military rules of procedure one, it includes civil actions unless something's excluded. Look, rule 81, certain kinds of habeas are excluded, like this one. And that the issue with Bacchio may be just a reason. The reason is they look at legislative history, and when Judge McKee, Judge Strzok and I looked at it, just the literal words, there's a Supreme Court case of 49 collapse. Excluded. And here you have everything included except tort actions. So they are specifically excluded. Doesn't say habeas.
Well, Judge Ambrose, when I said carve out, what I was describing is that the Second Circuit in Bacchio, it had to distinguish its prior case in Bowden, which held that habeas proceedings are unique hybrid proceedings that are not civil actions under the EJA. And the way the Second Circuit distinguished it is it said, well, if the petitioner is challenging immigration detention, well, that all of a sudden becomes a civil action that's unambiguous in the statutory text. And the reason why that is flawed is because the Second Circuit actually found that it was ambiguous. Even when challenging an immigration detention, it was ambiguous whether it was a civil action under the EJA. But then instead of resolving that ambiguity in favor of the government as the clear statement rule required the court to do, it then looked to legislative history and policy considerations to resolve the ambiguity, which the clear statement rule under the United States versus, or, sorry, under FAA versus Cooper and the Kurtz case, courts are not allowed to look at legislative history to resolve an ambiguity in the text in the sovereign immunity context.
What about the Ninth Circuit in Hill?
The Ninth Circuit in Hill is a readily distinguishable case. That court also looked at legislative history to interpret the phrase civil action. It didn't even discuss the need to narrowly construe ambiguous terms when dealing with waivers of sovereign immunity. So I'm not sure if they even applied the correct clear statement rule standard. And well,
they looked at purpose over text, but we're starting where just everybody tells us to start today, and that is text. Any civil action. Why is any limited other than with respect to the specific exception for torts?
Well, any is limited because...
Are we being hyperlitical? Hyperliteral?
I'm not sure if that's the way I would describe it, Judge Ambrose, but if habeas petitions in the immigration context are not civil actions to begin with, well, the phrase any does not modify...
That puts the rabbit in the hat. What is it that justifies the first part of that statement? If they're not civil actions to begin with, when we, and I think you're agreeing, historically, from the Supreme Court on down, they've been looked at as a species, if you will, of civil actions. Now, I can say they're hybrid, and I won't disagree with that. But to me, a hybrid just means that a particular species of civil actions, which Congress had to be aware of, given all of the legislation Congress has given us in the habeas area from AEDPA and others. They knew that habeas was out there. They could really easily have carved out habeas the way they carved out torts, and they didn't do that. They just said any, except for torts.
Well, Judge Amber, Judge McKee, getting to the so-called tort exception, well, if habeas was not a civil action in the first place, then there would be no need for Congress to create a carve-out like it did for torts.
Well, what would Congress have in mind to lead it to conclude that habeas would not be considered a civil action by courts looking at that statute? What would move them to that point?
Well, Congress would have in mind Harris and the Schlanger court's holding where it discussed that the civil label is not enough in every statutory context to scoop up habeas.
They'd then be aware of the fact that courts have given a civil label to habeas, which would be all the more reason for them to say, look, guys, let's exclude habeas because we don't want to have this statute included, interpreted to include habeas, and it's out there. So let's make sure we exclude it. I mean, that cuts against you.
Well, Judge McKee, it's plausible to read the phrase civil action as Congress was aware of the hybrid nature of habeas proceeding, that the label is gross and inexact, and its familiarity with the habeas statutes themselves to not intend for civil action to include habeas. When you look at the various habeas statutes, they're very focused on the underlying criminal proceedings. And I know this case is in the immigration context. When you look at the precise statute immigration detainees use to challenge their detention, 2241C3, it's addressed towards prisoners. That statute is normally used to challenge the execution of a criminal sentence. And so just because this is immigration detention, the hybrid vehicle is what we're looking at. And just because immigration detainees use a hybrid vehicle to challenge their detention, it does not mean that the vehicle all of a sudden becomes a civil action when courts of appeal are in agreement that whenever there's been a criminal detention, that it is not a civil action under the EJA. And it also wouldn't make sense
for... So there is a distinction then from your perspective between immigration detention and criminal detention in the habeas context?
Well, no, the government, as far as the government disagrees with the Vecchio court and the recent decision from the 10th Circuit and Bailey that have created this distinction based on the underlying detention. What I'm saying is that the course of appeals that have held that the hybrid nature of habeas renders it not a civil action when the criminal detention is being challenged, that also extends to immigration detention because it's the statute itself that's hybrid. It doesn't matter what type of detainee is using that statute to challenge the detention. If habeas is not a civil action under the EJA when dealing with criminal detention, it also is not when dealing with immigration detention because the statute itself does not bifurcate itself based on the underlying detention types. Again, the Vecchio court created this distinction not from the text of the EJA, not from the text of any of the habeas statutes. It created it by looking to legislative history and the policy considerations it gleaned from the legislative history, which it could not have done. Again, the Vecchio court itself admitted that it was ambiguous to that court whether habeas petitions challenging immigration detention or civil actions under the EJA, which should have resulted in a finding in favor of the government preserving immunity.
But would the reverse or the inverse of what you're saying be true? Let's assume you're arguing that if the underlying detention is criminal, that that doesn't necessarily make habeas proceedings criminal, that they still remain in this hybrid category.
They're still labeled as civil, correct?
Still labeled as civil. What if we were to disagree with your argument that the fact that it might be hybrid takes out of the language any, and we were to conclude that it is a civil proceeding for purposes of EJA? Would that then, given your argument, would that then mean that also habeas proceedings brought to challenge a criminal detention would also be civil?
I'm sorry, can you just repeat that one more time?
Yeah, it follows from your argument. If we disagree with your argument, doesn't it then follow that habeas petitions brought to challenge criminal confinement would be civil?
If you would disagree with my argument that habeas is a hybrid proceeding, then yes.
Not that it's a hybrid proceeding, but whether or not the fact that it's a hybrid proceeding disqualifies it from being considered a civil proceeding for purposes of a statute saying any civil proceeding.
If I understand your question correctly, Judge McKee, if the court disagrees and says that habeas is not a hybrid proceeding, that it's a purely civil action, well, then yes, that would reach criminal and immigration habeas. But no court of appeal that's ever addressed a habeas petition in the criminal context has held that. And I think this court is bound by its finding in Santana that habeas is a unique hybrid proceeding. And when you apply that finding in the EJA context, it aligns this court with the rest of the circuits that have examined the issue. It aligns this court where EJA is not a civil action under the EJA because of its hybrid, habeas is not a civil action under the EJA because of its hybrid nature.
Can we go to the second issue?
Yes, Judge Amber, I did want to briefly touch on the purpose of the EJA and how that plays in, if the court had any questions about that.
Go ahead.
Thank you. To the extent that this court, I see my time.
No,
go ahead. Nice try, though, Mr. It never works. But I love when trying.
Chief Judge Becker should say, you're on our time.
Well, I appreciate the court's indulgence. I did just want to briefly point out, to the extent that the court considers the purpose, stated purpose of the EJA, not anything from legislative history, but the purpose stated in 202C of the public law, to the extent it considers that to help answer the question of what civil action is, that purpose actually cuts in favor of the government for a few reasons. First is because detainees, whether in criminal or immigration detention, they already have a custodial incentive to challenge their detention. They didn't need the EJA and promise of attorney's fees to motivate them to challenge that.
May not be able to get a lawyer. In fact, they can challenge something. Doesn't mean they're going to get a lawyer when the lawyer's not going to get paid.
Yes, but the question is whether reading the EJA to exclude habeas, would that frustrate the stated purpose? And would the government's reading frustrate the stated purpose? It would not because, again, the detainees already have a custodial incentive. EJA wasn't designed to motivate people to file habeas petitions. As the Second Circuit in Bowden observed, habeas flourished long before EJA was proposed. And secondly, there aren't significant obstacles to filing habeas petitions that the EJIA cures. The filing fee is only $5, so there's not a financial obstacle for petitioners to file habeas petitions. And
what about the fact that they don't have a lawyer? This is not easy legal terrain, this habeas world.
Well, Judge Restrepo, pro se petitioners, they file habeas petitions all the time, and district courts understand habeas and how to adjudicate these cases in a way that protects the petitioner's rights, even when...
how many of them are successful? Do you have a rough idea? How many pro se habeas petitions, as opposed to counseled habeas petitions, are successful?
Well, Judge McKee, I know that plaintiffs cited a law review article that said that habeas petitioners that immigration are challenging immigration detention that are represented are seven times more likely to succeed. I would say that those stats aren't really reliable because this court evaluates a habeas petition on a case-by-case basis. We don't know whether the people who are unsuccessful filed within 10 days of being confined where it would not have been unreasonable or whether it was, you know, a year or 2 years. So there's just too much case-by-case dependency on the facts to really put a lot of weight into those statistics. And then the final point I'll just make about purpose is that EJIA wasn't designed to be an access to counsel or a statute addressing the issue of indigency for habeas petitioners. The Criminal Justice Act already allows, gives district courts discretion on whether to appoint court-appointed counsel to habeas petitioners, regardless of the type of detention they're challenging. And the habeas allows people with net worths of up to $2 million.
How often do courts appoint counsel under the CJA in an immigration case?
We cited...
Not a criminal case, but an immigration case.
Yes, in footnote 4 of the government's reply brief, we cited a few examples of district courts doing that. The language is general in the CJA, and so courts have exercised their discretion even when there's been immigration detention at issue. And
on the second issue, you've got 16 months detention and appeared on behalf of the government that there was no inclination necessarily to curtail that. Haven't we previously held that more than 5 months, or other courts have also held that more than 5 months makes it suspect?
I believe the language was 5 or 6 months, something more than that makes it suspect, yes.
So we got 16 months, and so why do we not, what's the argument against Mr. Bahia?
Well, a couple answers to that, Jambro. One, that we're not appealing the habeas petition, so we're not reevaluating the Herman Santos factors. What we're doing is seeing if the district court abused its discretion when looking at the record from the habeas litigation and then finding the government had zero basis in fact and law. And the government, to have been substantially justified, needed only to have a basis in fact and law. It didn't have to be justified to a high degree, and that's a low bar that the government cleared here. The record of the habeas litigation shows that the district judge found the most important Herman Santos factor to be concededly a close call. And with the remaining three factors, the parties split two of them and the other was neutral. And it's unlikely there would be any close calls if the government had zero basis in fact and law, as the district court that took over the case from the habeas judge found. And the second thing, when you mentioned, Judge Amber, that this court in the past has found detention unreasonable, and you know there were certain lengths of time at issue in those particular cases. But what the court here essentially did was create a bright line rule saying any time an individual has been detained for more than 12 months, well, the government is never substantially justified in opposing a habeas petition. But that goes directly against this court's precedent, Herman Santos, that explicitly declined to adopt a presumption of reasonableness or unreasonableness of any duration. Thank you.
Thanks. See you on rebuttal. Good afternoon, Mr. Sharon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Will Sharon on behalf of appellees. There are two important points in this case. The first is that habeas is civil. The Supreme Court has said it time and again, including in the years and months before EJIA was enacted. This court has also said it, and the Tenth Circuit said it last week in interpreting EJA. The second important point is that the statute EJA applies to, quote, any civil action other than cases sounding in tort. That means it applies to civil actions that aren't garden variety, to use the government's term, to proceedings that are technically civil despite some unique or hybrid features, and to civil actions even if they don't follow all of the federal rules of civil procedure. In other words, EJA applies to any civil action besides torts, and as the Supreme Court expressly said months before EJA was enacted, quote, habeas corpus is a civil action. The government's contrary argument rests on a misapplication of the sovereign immunity canon. What the government is really asking for is the exact magic words requirement that the Supreme Court has disavowed over and over again in its sovereign immunity cases.
Is habeas hybrid, in other words, somehow straddles the line between criminal and civil, even though it's in the civil portion of the federal code?
Habeas is not hybrid. The Supreme Court has said over and over and over again in countless cases that habeas is civil. It's civil in nature. It's a civil proceeding. It's a civil suit. It's a civil action. The Supreme Court has said it over and over, and it said it about statutes that use the phrase civil action. Judge McKee, you asked earlier, could Congress have excluded habeas in the same way it excluded torts from EJA? Congress actually did that in the filing fee statute, which says any civil action, suit, or proceeding except habeas. Congress amended that statute in 1978, including that language, right before enacting EJA in 1980. So Congress clearly knew how to exclude habeas from the phrase any civil action, and it knew that it needed to if it wanted habeas out from that phrase, but it didn't do that in EJA.
Do you recognize a difference, or do you acknowledge a distinction between the civil habeas immigration context and the criminal habeas?
For purposes of EJA, the phrase any civil action encompasses all habeas. We think that's the best reading of the Supreme Court's case law. We think that's consistent with the history and with how habeas developed and came over as a facet of common law. That being said, we think the government's argument here, this hybrid theory, derives from the notion that habeas is a civil proceeding, concededly a civil proceeding, challenging a criminal detention.
Well, what about the criminal detention? I think that was the point of the question. I'd like to answer that too. Do you think the same argument applies in the context of a criminal confinement?
We think the same argument does apply because any civil action still encompasses habeas, and that is true whether the habeas proceeding is challenging a civil or criminal detention.
So then why can't you folks, or lawyers in your position, so to speak, pursue CJA appointments to get attorney's fees?
So this is an argument the government raises for the first time in their reply brief, and it's actually an unsettled question whether CJA counsel is even available in immigration detention proceedings when habeas petitioners challenge immigration detention. I think the only circuit to have weighed in on this question is the 11th, and it said no, you can't get CJA counsel when you're a habeas petitioner challenging a civil immigration detention. The cases the government cites, again in their reply brief for the first time, the government actually opposed CJA counsel in those cases. And then I should say, just as a general matter, CJA counsel is discretionary. So it's not as if people are just able to get CJA counsel and that, you know, makes EJA sort of irrelevant. All of this, by the way, is about statutory purpose. And I don't think even if the government were right about its statutory purpose rationale, that would somehow take habeas outside of EJA's plain text, especially given the overwhelming Supreme Court precedent and the history. I think I heard my friend concede that EJA, or that habeas, is labeled civil. That's what any civil action captures. That's what the word any does, is it takes in proceedings that are labeled civil, even if they have some unique or hybrid features. And I think that's where my friend and I disagree, but I think we have the better of the argument.
The problem that you have is you do have other circuits going the other way, the Fourth and the Fifth. You have the Supreme Court in dicta in a 1969 decision, Harris v. Nelson, that says that labeling habeas as civil was, quote, gross and inexact, close quote. So obviously there's some antipathy out there and other circuits with precedential opinions that are calling your position based on text into question.
Sure. So I can start with the circuits. I should say this is just the Fourth Circuit, by the way, and the Fifth Circuit. So they take the position that the government is adopting now, But we think that it's wrong because it relies on the premise that habeas is sort of this category unto itself. I think that's the phrase the Fourth Circuit uses and the phrase the government used today. But the problem with that is that we know that that statutes that cover civil action include habeas. We know because the Supreme Court has said that the venue transfer provision, which covers any civil action, applies to habeas. We know that the Supreme Court has issued numerous jurisdictional holdings on the basis that habeas is civil. So it cannot be true that habeas is something else altogether, or else none of those holdings would make sense. None of those statutes would apply to habeas at all. So I think what the government does in its brief, and this is a sort of, it depends on which page you look at, but I think what they're actually saying is that, okay, yes, habeas is technically civil. We acknowledge that. Every court always has said it is at least technically civil, but they say, it doesn't necessarily fall within because a statute can use the phrase civil action and not necessarily intend to include the entire universe of civil actions. The problem with that, again, is that EJIA says any civil action. So that's Congress's effort to say, don't misconstrue this statute for one of the statutes that includes a narrower subset of civil actions. Don't misconstrue this statute for the statute at issue in Schlanger and Stafford, which included civil actions but was limited to mandamus-like actions. So where the Supreme Court said, actually in Stafford, it said, even though habeas is civil, we need to look at the legislative history of this particular statute to assess which civil actions it actually governs. And so the court was saying that this statute in Schlanger and Stafford encompasses a subset of civil actions. If you ask the same question about EJIA, does it encompass a subset of civil actions or does it encompass the entire universe? The question is obvious on the face of the statute. It covers any civil action other than cases sounding in tort. And again, Judge McKee, to your point earlier, Congress has excluded habeas from the statutory language, any civil action. It did that in the filing fee statute. So it clearly knows. I know we're not tied to legislative history at this point, but for whatever it's worth, DOJ came to Congress when Congress was considering enacting EJIA, and it said, don't enact this statute. This is going to be expensive, and here's a breakdown of the cost. And one of the costs the government cited was habeas petitions, prisoner petitions. So the government came to Congress and said, this is going to cost you more money because it covers habeas. And Congress said, okay, we understand that. It cited that point by the DOJ, that cost estimate, in enacting the statute, and it said, that's fine. We're okay with incurring that cost, and it did so anyway. I'd like to take a moment, if I may, to address the government's sovereign immunity argument. As the Tenth Circuit reasoned last week in the decision in the parallel version of this case, the traditional tools of statutory interpretation are not displaced by the sovereign immunity canon. So you have to go through these tools. You have to look at the text in context, the time it was written, considering the history of the phrase civil action and the history of habeas, and to an extent the purpose of the statute, and determine whether after you've exhausted all of those tools, there is any lingering ambiguity. So the Supreme Court in Richland actually did this with EJIA. It said at the outset there was some ambiguity in a particular provision of EJIA regarding paralegal fees. So it goes through the statutory interpretive tools. It asks about its precedent. It asks about the structure of the statute, and to an extent it asks about the legislative history. And it concludes, even though there was originally ambiguity in the phrase, after we've exhausted these tools, that ambiguity is resolved. And there's no need to, quote, resort to the sovereign immunity canon. And so the court doesn't. And that's consistent with the Supreme Court sovereign immunity cases across the board. And it's consistent with how the Tenth Circuit resolved this issue just last week. My friend also talked a little bit about Santana, and I'd like to address that case just for a moment. So Santana does what I think we're asking the court to do today, which is say at the outset that habeas is civil. Santana says it's technically civil, and so it fits within the literal scope of the PLRA. That's a quote from Santana. The PLRA says civil action, and so habeas fits within its literal scope. Then this court goes through a statutory interpretation analysis and asks, is there a reason to think that Congress meant to include a narrower subset of civil actions that excludes habeas? And it turns out there's actually really powerful evidence in the PLRA that that's exactly what Congress was doing. So Judge McKee, you mentioned the purpose of the PLRA, but there's also the fact that it establishes an elaborate payment plan for filing fees. And as I think my friend noted, the filing fee in a habeas case is $5. So it would make no sense to establish this elaborate payment installment plan for a $5 filing fee. And that's pretty good evidence that the PLRA doesn't tie it to habeas, even though habeas fits within its literal scope because it says civil action. Ask that same question about EJA, and again, you see no evidence like there was in the PLRA, and instead you see that the statute uses the phrase any civil action, of course, other than cases sounding in tort. The government mentioned briefly at this point about a custodial incentive, and I'd like to address that for just a minute. This is another argument that I don't think we see in the government's reply brief, and one that the Tenth Circuit rejected for basically just that reason last week. But even if the government were right about this custodial incentive purpose about in EJA, there is no evidence that it would override the plain text of the statute. So the government can't use this sort of argument that maybe habeas doesn't further every purpose of EJA, therefore it's excluded despite fitting within the plain text. I don't think that's the correct way to do statutory interpretation in this case, but I think it also overlooks the fact that EJA serves a deterrent purpose. The Supreme Court has said that. That's the flip side of creating an incentive to challenge other unjustified government conduct, is to deter unjustified government conduct. And the way you deter conduct through EJA is by allowing people to bring counseled petitions when the government's position is unjustified, and to allow the prospect of attorney's fees to dissuade the government from taking unjustified positions in the first place. Finally, to the extent the argument is that there's an incentive to bring the challenge already and therefore EJA need not apply, that same point is true about other civil actions that nobody disputes EJA covers. So for example, Social Security Administration appeals. Somebody who loses before an ALJ on a Social Security claim has just lost effectively their ability to obtain their livelihood. They have every incentive to appeal that to the district court, but that doesn't somehow mean EJA doesn't apply because they have an independent incentive to bring the challenge. And that's true of a lot of different types of civil actions EJA covers. If there are no more questions on the civil action, I can briefly address the substantial justification point.
Please go ahead on the substantial justification.
Sure. So as the court noted at the outset, the government detained Mr. Ebbie for 16 and ultimately 18 months in abysmal conditions without even a hearing to determine whether his continued detention was necessary. The district judge did not abuse his discretion in awarding attorney's fees for litigating whether he could get a bond hearing. And that last point I think is just important and worth emphasizing. Mr. Abioye wasn't asking for release. His habeas petition was not saying, let me go, it's been 18 months, I need to be released. He was asking, can I get a hearing? May I go before a judge who can assess whether I'm a flight risk or a risk to the community? And the government's position, the one that we're reviewing ultimately on abuse of discretion review, was no, you don't even get a hearing on whether you can be released. And that's a little bit different from, I think, what may, you know, come through as him asking for release outright.
When was the line crossed here from unreasonable to justified, that failed to justify further confinement without a hearing?
I wouldn't say that there is a clear point where the line was crossed. I think I would look at this court's decision in Chavez-Alvarez, where it says the line was crossed somewhere between 6 and 12 months. And it's interesting because Chavez-Alvarez actually has a footnote where the court says, even though the detention in that case ultimately was 18 months, and the facts are very similar between this case and that one, the court says in a footnote, even though we could just say that the detention was 18 months and that's unreasonable, we want to, quote, provide guidance to the AG and to district courts, and so we're going to specify with a little bit more clarity when the detention became unreasonable, and it was between 6 and 8 months. In Herman Santos, the court more recently says, or reiterates, I should say, that a detention becomes more and more suspect after 5 months. So I think we're well beyond sort of the realm where this would have been reasonable, and this court doesn't need to say, especially on abuse of discretion review, that there was a particular line at a particular day. And I see my time is up, but we ask.
Yes, does the fact that the government either did not know or they clearly misstated the grounds, the statute pursuant to which he was being held, does that move the Herman Santos line at all?
So I think, Judge McKee, that might be a reference to the Mitchell case.
The 1226.
At that one, the government is not even contesting that their position was unjustified. They're not appealing that issue. So I think that, does that answer your question?
Kind of. It's a hybrid answer.
Yeah, hybrid answer, right. That may be the best I can do. Okay. But if there are no more questions, we ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask you to pick up with the second issue? Did you say previously that you didn't think that the German Santos factors were in play here?
Judge Ambrose, they're not in play on this appeal. Only relevance they have is when we look at what the judge who adjudicated the habeas petition, what that judge found when she evaluated the Herman Santos factors. And she found that it was a close call. Of course, here, Mr. Abioya's detention was 16 months when the government contested his habeas petition, and it was 18 months when the magistrate judge issued her habeas opinion. But she found it to be a close call, and again, that suggests that the government had a basis in fact and law for its opposition.
But the length of the detention was far more than the line that we say is at least suspect. And the likelihood detention will continue appeared to be substantial. What were the reasons for the delay?
Well, the reasons why Mr. Abioi was in detention at the time is because while he had a final order of removal, he was contesting that.
What were the reasons for delay in having a bond hearing?
Well, under the statute that Mr. Abioi was held under, 8 U.S.C. 1226C, that does not allow the government to give him a bond hearing, and so that's why he was being held without one. It's detention without the possibility of bond. But I just want to reiterate that this court in Herman Santos, it explicitly declined to adopt the blind presumption of reasonableness. Chavez-Alvarez said reasonableness is decided on a case-by-case basis, and that's what the district judge did here. She said, under the facts of this case, it's concededly a close call on the most important factors, and the other factors went both ways.
But even if it's a close case, how does she come down?
She came down on the side of the petitioner, but under the substantial justification case law, just because the government loses on the merits, that doesn't mean that it was not substantially justified in its litigation position. I do just want to address just a couple other points about the sovereign immunity issue. So what the government's proposing that the court does here is consistent with the Richland case. There's ambiguity here because the Supreme Court has said that the label civil is not enough to automatically include habeas petitions. In
the certain contexts it does, but in this case, what you're basically, you've got two circuits going one way, two circuits going the other way. And we're saying to you, it looks like, especially in this day and age, which has changed dramatically in the last half century, that you look at the literal text first. And we're having problems getting beyond the literal text. Any civil action but for those sounding in tort. If I'm having a casual conversation with someone, that's to understand. It doesn't appear that there's a whole lot of nuance in that declaration.
Well, Judge Ambrose, the government's position is that when you examine the rest of the text, it still does not resolve the ambiguity because the government respectfully disagrees that the word any solves the problem because, again, if habeas is not a civil action in the first place because it's this hybrid type of proceeding, then any does not modify the phrase civil action to include habeas. And with the tort exception, by looking at the fact that Congress did not explicitly exclude habeas the way it did for torts, well, that's an inversion of the way the clear statement rule analysis is supposed to work. The question is whether Congress explicitly included habeas, not whether it excluded it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank all counsel for their arguments in their briefs. We'll